My name is Ed Goldberg, and I have the pleasure of speaking with Tom Rackman. Tom, welcome to Cable, and welcome to Portland.
Thank you very much.
First time in Portland?
No, I've been here a couple of times before.
But you've lived in Vancouver,
that's
BC.
Right, yeah.
So you're part of our northwestern Cascadia.
Exactly. I'm part of the mountain range.
The title of your book is The Imperfectionist. This is the paperback, and your name is spelled R-I-C-H-M-A-N, and it's published by Dial Press. Let me read a little bit about you here. Tom was born in 1974 in London, grew up in Vancouver, we just said that, studied cinema at the University of Toronto, and completed a master's degree in journalism at Columbia. Smart kid. From 1998, you worked as an editor in the foreign desk of the Associated Press in New York, did a stint as a reporter in India and Sri Lanka. Before returning to New York in 2002, you went to Rome as an AP correspondent. You've had quite a career for a young man, with assignments taking you to Japan, South Korea, Turkey, and Egypt. Beginning in 2006, he worked part-time as an editor at the International Herald Tribune en Paris to support himself while writing fiction. You now live in London, and you're working on your second novel. Now, this novel, The Imperfectionist, is a novel told in chapters, and each chapter highlights a different person who works at this unnamed newspaper, an English-language newspaper in Rome. And they're connected by short chapters that detail the history of the newspaper, a couple of pages each. But what occurs to me is that the newspaper business must be changing, has to be changing. It's subject to pressures and subject to competition, that's the word I'm trying to get, from other sources now, including especially online. And yet you love the newspaper business, and you clearly don't want it to go away. But in a sense, I'm guessing you almost have a nostalgia for a time you didn't live through. Is that true?
That's a very perceptive comment indeed, because I think that that the truth is that I worked in journalism and in the newspaper business for the best part of a decade, and I didn't always love working in the business. In fact, I usually disliked it quite a bit. And I find myself...
Why? Just out of...
Well, I think that it just didn't really suit me temperamentally. I love reading, and I love reading the news, but when I actually had to go out there and sort of, you know, scream questions out at a press conference and elbow my way to the front and stick a microphone into the face of the sort of grieving widow, I just felt ill doing it, and it didn't feel natural to me. And you know, I coped the best that I could, and there were certain things that I wanted to do overseas in particular that I certainly pushed for with great ambition. But throughout it all, I always felt like I was almost in somebody else's job, mm-hmm. Bit of an imposter.
Well, we all feel that way one time or another. Yeah. I do, unless you have such incredible self-confidence that you're a freak of nature.
Right.
I won't get into this deeply now, but one of your characters named Winston is so monumentally inept at asking questions, but he's really not suited to the job at all. Did you put a little bit of yourself into Winston?
I think I did. You know, none of the characters is quite me, but there is certainly something in his experience that I remember all too well from journalism, especially in the early days before I really knew what I was doing and I knew how to do it, that there's this awful experience that you can have when you're dropped into a situation and you need to produce a story and you really have no idea where to start. It might seem like it should be obvious, and in certain cases it is obvious, but in many, many more, you might turn up in a city and you think, well, you know, now I'm just standing here at the bus stop, and where do I get all of the little ingredients that somehow would compose a story? How do I transform the multiplicity of experience into copy? And you've meanwhile got the editors screaming at you for updates, and it's a terrifying experience.
Well, you know, they say that a lot of people work best under that kind of terror. That fear is a great motivator in a lot of ways, and sometimes people do their best work with that. That didn't suit you at all, though.
I don't know. I think that I'm not sure that fear does me much good in any respect. Just makes me go pale. But
no fight. It's always flight for you.
Exactly. I'm very, very much an advocate of the flight. But I think that I do think, though, that there are many people who do thrive on that. And indeed, it is kind of the euphoria of the job is when you get it, you know, when the story's in and it makes the front page or whatever it is. And and you have that thrill of having accomplished something. As with any endeavor, I imagine that the more difficult it is once it's realized, then it's particularly satisfying. But I suppose that I would always have kind of a stress hangover in those situations, that I would be a little bit frazzled leaving the office each night. And so it wasn't quite for me, I don't think.
Mm-hmm. Each of the chapters is about a character and the people around the character, not just the people in the newspaper, but the people in their personal lives as well. And this is, you seem to have a gift for describing, and not just describing, but understanding the fragile human ego, the little core inside of us that is constantly in terror, constantly needs to be guarded and constantly needs to be overcompensated for, in some cases more than others. Whether you do this by self-deception or you do it by arrogance, which is, I suppose, a form of the same thing, you seem to understand that very well. But yet, and this is, I think, a high compliment to you, is that your characters are not simply a bag of foibles and faults. They live. I'm impressed.
Well, thank you. Thank you. It's
I don't know. There's not a question in there, but how do you feel your observation and analysis of the human character? How did you get into that? How did you achieve that level of understanding?
Well, it would be nice to blame my parents, who are both psychologists, and perhaps they somehow brought me up rightly or wrongly to be...
You came out relatively normal. That's
a
shock to begin with.
You don't know me that well yet.
You're really good in polite company, though.
No, I think that somehow, whether it was inherited or just picked up at the dinner table, I was brought up being really fascinated by other people's brains and other people's minds and thoughts. And so I always paid close attention to people, and I spent a lot of time, and continue to, with members of my family talking about other people, not just maligning them, but, you know, talking about other people in the sense of trying to understand how they're working and what's going wrong or what's going right. And so I suppose that interest and that fascination is also what drew me to reading much before I wanted to write. I think that's the best fiction contains a degree of psychological penetration that we struggle, to ever achieve in our daily interactions. And it's that sort of peek into another person's mind that always was so attractive to me.
Mm-hmm. Buried deep inside your response, it was one word: you didn't malign people. And I can say that however these characters display bad behavior, you have affection for them. You're not judging them, really. You're just letting them work out their neuroses because that's what people do. Did you envision the work that way?
I don't know that I did, but that's exactly how it ended up being, and how I'm pleased that it is that way and that it comes off that way, because even though many of these characters, were I to encounter them in real life, I think could be quite difficult people to deal with, there's something about the process of writing a character, as much as there is about reading a character, that accentuates your sense of empathy for another person in the most wonderful way, I think. And I think it's one of the most stirring things about reading and writing is that effect that it has. Because I always think about how when you encounter somebody in real life, you and they each have their own trajectory. So you're coming to this meeting with one particular wish and they with another, and perhaps they're shared and you can get along well or not, and there's a clash. But when you're encountering fiction, reading or writing it, then you have absolutely no trajectory in that story. And those characters have the trajectory, and you're able to just watch and watch with a greater degree of sympathy than is easily accessible in life. And so I think that's really what it all comes from. And the last thing I would say on that is that I think that as an author, you have such a great amount of power over the characters. I mean, you can be very cruel because you can see their lives with such precise detail that you can point out things in a way that would mock them and would be unpleasant. And I find that almost to be an abuse of the role of the author. I don't think that it's the equivalent to sort of playground bullying, you know, that what's interesting in other human beings in this context is trying to understand them and not trying to mock them. It's just easy and cheap.
Yeah, like playing God.
Yeah.
Yeah, except not a good God.
I
was going to go through the chapters serially, you know, from beginning to end, but there's a couple that rise to the top for a number of reasons. And one is the story of Annika and Craig. And the reason that to me that was the most heartbreaking story in the book, I just, well, at the end of that particular chapter, I just felt as though, God, this is terrible. This really shouldn't have happened. Can you tell us about Annika and Craig?
Sure. They are a couple, and he is the news editor at this newspaper in Rome. And he's a man who's known within the office for nothing but work. All he does is sit there and work from dawn almost until nighttime. He's there before anybody else arrives and leaves after everyone else has left. And what we find out in this story is that there's a great deal more in his life than just the news. And in particular, what there is this woman whom he's living with, Annika. And he's deeply in love with her, but he recognizes, or he has such a low view of himself in a certain way, that he has this fear that she hasn't quite cottoned on to the fact that he's really not quite worth her value, and that she's with him and doesn't quite get it, that she oughtn't to be. And so he's simultaneously sort of clinging to her and hoping that she desperately that she won't notice. And also working away at this job that he doesn't particularly like, because he recognizes that in keeping her there in Rome, then he has something at least to offer her, because she gets to live in a wonderful city, and that perhaps that's what's keeping her there. But then something happens in their relationship, and I won't detail it for readers who haven't had a chance to see the book. But that's
I will say I picked up the heavy foreshadowing right at the beginning, where she does it teasingly and mockingly, complains about having to wash his socks. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's right away I saw the crack in the facade. You know?
Yeah, it's a bad sign when people start talking about washing socks.
Exactly right, yeah. If your relationship has devolved to that.
Exactly.
I'd like to remind our listeners that I'm speaking with Tom Rackman. The title of his book is The Imperfectionists, and it's published by Dial Press. Along with affection for your characters, you also have great affection for Rome. And the little bit of time I spent in Rome, I love that place. It's dirty, it's noisy, it's expensive. There's any number of things wrong with it, as there are with any major city. Yet you know you're in a real city, and the place has been a real city for 3,000 damn years. How do you feel about Rome, really?
Well, I love many aspects of Rome, and I hate many aspects of Rome. And I lived there for about 4 years in total. And I have so many personal affections that are tied into my memories. It's sort of hard to somehow tease out exactly what I feel about the city per se. But I guess that what is wonderful about it, and what draws so many people to Italy in general, is the feeling, especially as an outsider, that there's this sort of raw humanity that you're seeing, that everything is bared, and people are, you know, shouting out the windows at each other, or you know, gesticulating wildly, and all of that is true, and all of that is extremely attractive, especially if you're from a more reserved, retiring sort of Anglo-Saxon background, as many of us are. And so I think that is and always was a huge draw. However, when you've lived there for a while, and when you speak the language, and when you become integrated a bit more into the culture, then you recognize, as you rightly said, that this place has some troubles too. And in certain respects, Rome is rather a parochial place. And once you stay there for a while, you feel a little restricted. That
parochial in every sense of the word.
Oh yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. And that you know, sometimes Romans, well, not Romans, but sometimes there's a feeling there that Italy is the world, and that you're a little far more detached than if you were, say, in Paris or another of the great capitals there.
Yeah, the unlamented Mussolini tried to instill in Italians the idea that they were once the center of the universe.
Yes.
and that they should be again.
Yes.
But of course he kind of went about it the wrong way. And if you've ever been to that hideous railway station in Venice, you know exactly that he went about it the wrong way.
Yes.
Let's talk about another story. I want to talk about Ornella. Now, Ornella doesn't work at the paper. But Ornella reads the paper, but she's a little behind in her reading. Tell us about Ornella.
Well, Ornella is an avid reader of the newspaper. Avid is probably an understatement. She's so obsessive about reading the paper, about reading every article and every edition, that she has fallen years and years behind. And she will not move on to the next edition until she's completed the one she's on. And over the course of years, she's fallen 1 year, 2 years, 3 years back. And she's then constructed in her life a sort of cocoon whereby none of the news of the day will can penetrate, so that she can continue on with her soap opera and never have the next you know, sort of the end of the Reagan presidency explained to her, or the and so forth. So that's really that's her story, and I added that one into the book because all of the other characters are in some way work at this newspaper and are much closer to its orbit. She, however, is sort of the other side of the paper. She is the person reading it, and thereby you get another view of the publication.
Yeah, and you also get a view of a specific kind of obsessive compulsive disorder.
Yes.
Also, I really the way she treated her poor housekeeper is just it goes part and parcel with being a little nuts, I guess.
Yeah, definitely. She's. I think as well that as the story goes on, I mean, I hope that the readers see that while she is unforgivably insensitive to her maid, she's also totally reliant on her and has a real
and that's why perhaps
yeah and is kind of a desperate woman and is doing what so many people do, in that awful thing of taking out their frustrations on the one person who will let them, you know, the one person who deserves it least.
Mm-hmm. Now, she's peripherally related to the newspaper by what I would call if there was an organization chart, it would be a couple of offshoots. She is the mother of Dario, is that correct?
That's correct.
And Dario is the old flame of Kathleen, and Kathleen is the managing editor of the newspaper. She's the one that really runs the
place.
She's
the executive editor. Yeah, that's right.
And Kathleen is a piece of work in herself. She, I don't know, how can I describe her? She's exacting. She's a bit of a martinet. There's only one person in the newspaper, Herman, who she considers her equal intellectually or in terms of the knowledge of the business. And yet she also has a deep longing inside that she can't seem to satisfy. And her husband, Nigel, is a boyfriend, husband?
Husband.
Husband, yeah. Wow, okay. Dario is her old boyfriend.
Yes.
And Dario is now working not for Berlusconi per se, but for his right-wing party.
That's right.
Yes. And he always said, he keeps telling, well, you understand, I was always on the right. I was always on the right. But Nigel is one of these boring, tendentious leftists who just have to tell you everything that's wrong with the world. And therein lies the dynamic. Tell us about them.
Yeah. I enjoyed dropping a bit of politics into that story, and I enjoyed as well the sort of the social banter and the way that people in a social sense will often take up political positions. I found that I always find that fascinating, that politics in and of itself is interesting and policy is fascinating, but I think it's particularly interesting to see how people will align themselves with one or another group, partly for those social reasons. And in this case, her husband, who's a stay-at-home husband, and he's taken on progressive politics, and he likes to sort of in a way compensate for the fact that he's not really contributing very much to their life by just spouting off a lot of rhetoric all the time and making himself feel important that way. And the sort of counterbalance is this guy who's on the right and working for Berlusconi, you know, a character who doesn't need an introduction.
And, bunga bunga.
Yeah, exactly. And so there's that other side of it, and there's the sort of paradox of Kathleen herself in the middle, who's, you know, sort of center left, let's say, liberal type person, and she finds herself rather more drawn to the guy whose politics are farther from her, and there's then the whole complexity and question of how do you feel about that?
Yeah, but you set up the equation very neatly, because Nigel may be more politically simpatico with her, or she with him, but he's aggressive and never shuts up, whereas Dario, for a right winger, is remarkably passive and accommodating.
Yeah. It's interesting, actually, that I think that one's sense of left and right changes it when you go to Europe, because the alignments are not quite the same as they are here. Mm-hmm. And so you can meet all sorts of people who you would think, oh, in the States they would be liberal, and in Europe they're conservative. And it's the whole thing is sort of thrown up in the air.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's also something else in this chapter that shows, again, wisdom about the human condition. Never, ever, indulge in a post-mortem about your relationship with a former lover. Never do it. If they bring it up, say, I don't want to talk about it, leave the room, whatever you have to do, right?
Yeah, I think so. You're referring there to this scene where she meets up with Dario, this Italian man she had in a relationship with many years before when she was a young woman. And she says, you know, what was I like back then? And you know, I don't care anymore. That's a different me. And
lie.
Yeah. And I suppose that story or that conversation, I'm sure must have generated from that curiosity in me. You know, there's a part of I don't know if other people are like this, but there's certainly a part of me where I think, you know, when I meet an old girlfriend or something like that, I think, you know, she can tell me what I was really like, what I'm really like, perhaps even now, and she'll have an insight into me. And it's the sort of conversation you could never have with the present partner. And so I let my imagination run riot with that story to see what would happen if they did pursue that dangerous conversation.
It's a peculiarly poisonous form of egocentrism, if you ask me. I mean, it never comes out well.
I think you're absolutely right.
Yeah. I want to talk about Herman. I want to talk also if we... Yeah, we got only about 5-6 minutes left, maybe. I really need to talk a little bit about Winston and Rich Snyder. Tell us about Rich Snyder. I read a review where he was compared to Hunter Thompson. He's nothing like Hunter Thompson. No. First of all, Hunter Thompson never turned in many stories. This guy is working constantly.
Yeah. No, I don't think he's quite like Hunter S. Thompson either. I think he's more the archetype of the bullying, pushy foreign correspondent. There are these types out there, and not that by any means all foreign correspondents are like this. They're certainly not. But he's a character who, in this story, he turns up in Cairo, and there's this young reporter there, who, as we referred to earlier, has no idea what he's doing, and he's just trying desperately to muddle his way through. And then appears this man twice his age with very sharp elbows and a very aggressive guy who's been all around the world and just wants to boast and show off and wants to also take the young man's job. And so he's frankly a pretty despicable character, and
is he ever?
And you know,
totally ruthless. He's amoral. He's ambitious, poisonously ambitious.
Yep.
And he you know, people are just furniture to him to be pushed out of the way at his convenience.
I hate to say that I did encounter people somewhat like that, and in fact, even in my earliest days in the business, I remember because I had always been interested in international news, and I would sometimes meet these reporters out there, and even when I was just studying, and I would say, you know, they would tell me about, oh, I covered Bosnia and I did this and I did that, and I say, well, what was it actually like, you know, when you saw somebody being shot? I read that story and you saw them dying, and what was that like? And they would sort of look at me as if I was transparent, thinking, but you know, not even quite grasping the question. And that was sort of a shock to me, that I realized that there were some people who did the job who viewed it in everything, perhaps, in such an egocentric fashion that it was all just an extra dateline. And I was speaking before about how there's this, in the job, you do have to sort of translate the complexity of reality into a story. Well, there are some people who in that business, they stop remembering that those are actually human beings there, and they're instead just thinking about, you know, the thrill of it and the personal aggrandizement of it all, and they can be so astonishingly callous to those people that they deal with, and also to fellow reporters. And I have to add again that this isn't the rule, that there are lots of wonderfully very brave people doing that sort of jobs, but there's certainly this type too.
One has to have a certain distance from a story to be able to report it, but you know, there's a logical extreme to that, which this man tramples all over. I mean, he's trampled on it going away, because the only thing in the world that matters is him. I love this character. I thought he was a lot of fun, and poor Winston is such a. A nebbish, you know, that he's no hope at
all.
Well,
that was really the paradox that I wanted to show in that story too, is that there's something extraordinary in this, that sometimes by being aggressive and insensitive, you can actually end up getting a better story. That some of these guys I met who were monsters as people, they were producing amazing sensitive stories, and it's a surprise.
The one character in this book that I felt a personal kinship with was Herman Cohen. And the reason is that he's the standards guy in the paper. He not only doesn't he want you to misspell words, some of the words that people are relying more and more on spell check. So Saddam Hussein becomes Sadism Hussein in spell check. And that, of course, makes the paper look bad. It makes everybody look stupid. But he maintains an ever-changing volume called the Bible. Tell us what the Bible is.
The Bible is his style guide, and a style guide is something that every publication possesses, and it's the system of rules and spelling and exactly how they're going to format it. But he's such a pedant and so obsessed about the credibility of the newspaper that he just cannot resist adding another entry every or several entries a day. And this Bible, which started out at probably quite a reasonable size, by the time we pick up the story, I think it's more than 18,000 pages long, and he keeps adding new things.
Yeah, that's right. The other thing about this story is that it's not simply about Herman and his unreachable standards. He also has a friend named Jimmy, a kid he went to school with back when they were the only two Jews in a WASPy academy somewhere. And Jimmy was the golden boy, and Jimmy was going to be the star, and Jimmy was going to do this, and Jimmy was going to do that. And they're both very kind to each other over the years, to the extent that they will lie to each other and to themselves about the relationship just to make the other guy feel good. But ultimately, it turns out that Herman is much more valuable a human being than Jimmy is, who has fallen into a kind of torpor. That's very poignant.
It's a story where it's a strange situation where Herman has this self-perception that he's kept with him really since school days of being the second to this heroic friend of his, the guy who's going to go be a great writer, who's going to do all of the grand things that Herman feels he himself is far too inadequate to ever realize. And then, strangely, in his 60s, Jimmy turns up again, not having seen Herman for some time, and Herman is then forced to reassess not just his heroic friend, but also himself, and to look back at all of his years and think perhaps he'd misunderstood it all along.
Yeah, and the other thing you do is that he has a wonderful wife who loves him in spite of all his flaws.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
In fact, is she's the top dog in the house also.
Yeah,
not him.
Yeah,
yeah. What are you doing now?
I'm working on a second novel. And I'm a bit secretive about the subject matter.
No problem. You don't have to tell us.
It's going well, and I'm taking a break while I do this book tour I'm on, but I can't wait to get back to it.
Any idea when we might actually see it?
It's hard to say because it depends as well on the publishers when they wish to release it. But I hope within the next few years. Yeah.
Okay. Do you have a deadline?
I have a sort of vague deadline, but it's a generous one that I'm going to beat.
Okay, because my feeling about deadlines is I love the noise they make as they go whizzing by.
So. Exactly.
Yes. I've been talking with Tom Rachman. Again, his name is spelled R-A-C-H-M-A-N. The title of his book is The Imperfectionists, published by Dial Press. I sure hope you'll come back for your next book.
I absolutely will. Thank you.